and it was just such a whimper. I can deal with losing, but losing that like that, and specifically to Arsenal, no, it definitely has taken a bit of the shine off the season.
I think FIFA are in a difficult position in terms of punishment because they've had such a lax attitude to punishment for things that are far more serious crimes than wearing a poppy.
And the culture that he's currently instilled in that side is one where it's okay to lose.
I read something today that said Wolves have scored more goals against the Premier League top six than Man United have.
Hello everybody and welcome to this week's Football Fans Podcast, the podcast that gives real football fans a voice on the sport that we love. My name is Jordan, your host, and I'm joined on the pod this week by G and Steve. How are you doing, gentlemen?
Yeah, really good.
All good, George.
Well.
All good, mate. Yeah, not too bad.
G, Megan and Harry doing the thing, tying the knot. You know, you're going to be popping a bottle tonight in celebration?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, at one point, I was in line to get Megan, but she's kind of slipped off now, so I let her go to Harry, you know what I mean? And I'm happy with my business.
You're cool right now, yeah?
Yeah, you begging that in there. You begging that in there quickly.
I was going to say, there's going to be some sharp editing this week.
Or none. We've also joined this week by Ravit, who's with us. He was a Liverpool fan, but more for the sake of today's pod, we'll be discussing later in the pod, is the club secretary of Dulwich Hamlet. Ravit, how are you doing, sir?
Yeah, I'm all good.
You well?
Yeah, very well.
Good. We're going to talk Liverpool and Chelsea in just a moment, so we're going to get your views on the game itself. But before we get into it, I want to thank the listeners who tweeted and sent in lots of comments and messages regarding last week's pod. I personally thought it was a very, very interesting debate and a very enjoyable podcast, and the fans who made their points on the pod were articulate and intelligent. And Marvin, some thought the opinions were quite strong, but that's why the podcast is here, to give opinions that are honest and strong. And I think everybody made their points really well.
Disclaimer time.
I'm just going to say, I still want to distance myself from those comments.
This is not a podcast that's all nicey-nicey, so I enjoyed last week, it was good fun. Right, let's do some drive-bys, gentlemen. The rules, 60 seconds, and you cannot be interrupted by anybody else on the panel. Let's start with you, G.
I was going to say, you're not going to proper drop me in it
this week. I've been good this week, I've been nice this week. Or so you think. let's start with you, G. I was watching a thing on Sky last week about Messi's career. They do it like every 3 months, all his goals, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And they got to the bit where they were showing the latter years where he obviously was part of MSN. And I was thinking, that must be the best front three that's ever been in football. Yeah. I can think of a better one. So I was thinking, okay, and I'll ask you the question, can you think or can you make a composite front three that's better than MSN that doesn't involve any of those three?
Whew, do they have to all be playing at the same time?
As long as they're playing now.
It's not my place to step in, but just no.
Okay. I mean, you'd have Ronaldo, right?
Uh-huh. What two could you put with him that would be better than Messi, Neymar, and Suarez?
Ronaldo, Lewandowski. You know what? I tap out.
I couldn't think of one either, actually. Cool. Ravit, Callum Wilson at Bournemouth, he's banging goals at the moment. And I think even before he had his really bad injury, he had a really good start when Bournemouth came up into the Premier League. Do you think he is a striker, is better than Bournemouth, or do you think he's doing well? Because that's pretty much the level that he's at.
I think Bournemouth are one of, 14 clubs in the Premier League who are in a 14 league table, if that makes sense, because you've got your top six.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at it as if he's at Bournemouth's level, he's in one of those 14 clubs.
Mm-hmm.
If he's going to progress any higher, it's going to be at the top six. Mm-hmm. It'll probably be Everton next in sixth, or it's going to be the top five. Is he good enough for the top five? No chance.
Not that level.
Is he good enough to play for Everton? They could have a striker, someone who scores goals, so you know, that's probably up for debate. But I think for him, get to the end of the season playing for Bournemouth, if he continues to do what he does on the other side of Christmas, the new year, then assess it. But I think he's okay where he is at the moment.
You don't think Everton in the January might have a look at him? Do you think he's good enough to play for Everton that haven't got a striker at the moment.
I think that's the thing, they haven't got a striker full stop, and if it comes January time where he's banging in the goals for Bournemouth, then again it's all a bit of a debate as to which manager goes in to Everton. They might not be too keen on him as a player. If it's a foreign manager, he might want to bring someone else in from Europe. But hypothetically, he'd be a good fit for them just because they simply need goals. They need a striker. But I'm sure Eddie Howe won't want to let him.
No, for real. And Stephen, Chris Hughton, do you think he's underrated, or do you think he gets the requisite and appropriate amount of praise for the job that he's doing and done previously?
I think he seems like he's beginning to get the kind of respect he probably deserves now. I don't think he got it when he was in charge of Newcastle. There's a lot of people that questioned what he was about, and kind of always felt that, or Newcastle fans I think gave the impression they thought the club was bigger than Chris Hughton and kind of were looking for a more high profile manager. But he's proved he can go down to the Championship, he can get a team up that, you know, probably weren't fancy to come up to the Premier League, and he's doing okay with them in the Premier League, and people seem to respect him for that now, and probably rightly so too.
Cool. All right, let's get into the game, the standout game of the weekend, gentlemen. Liverpool-Chelsea finished 1-1. I'll start with you, Stephen. Everybody's talking at the moment about Kevin De Bruyne, and he does seem to be at the moment the standout player, or the leading candidate for Player of the Year, even at this early stage in November. But I was thinking,
rose-tinted glasses for Man City players, no?
Well, I was thinking about it before the game. And has Mohamed Salah got an argument to say that he's leading the race? And I say this because he's got 12, 13 goals now?
12 in the league, isn't it? I think it's 15 goals in 20 games.
In total. He's in an inferior team to Kevin De Bruyne.
Well, hang on.
What he is.
There's no need to say it either. We could have just had that discussion without chucking that line in. But yeah, go on.
Can you put an argument forward to suggest that he is currently leading the race for Player of the Year?
Well, you just said it. The stats probably back up that he is in the race for Player of the Year. And probably, if you based it purely on stats, then he's probably the leading candidate. He doesn't have the players around him that De Bruyne probably has.
I mean, we must say that he's not in a crappy team.
No, he's not in a poor side. He's in a good side, especially up top. Yeah, he's the man that's standing up every week, and he's the one scoring goals, and he's the one that looks like he's always a threat and creating danger for opposing defences and making chances for his teammates. So, he's been phenomenal for us this season. I always thought he was a decent signing. I didn't think he was going to turn out to be quite as good as he has.
You keep him in January or August.
Well, he's not according to me, though. He's off to Real Madrid, isn't he? I'm sure we'll hold on to him until the end of the season.
Also, on Salah, Rabbit. What was all that hands in the air, making a point of not celebrating?
No, it wasn't. What? You know why it was?
I don't.
Because of the Egypt terror attack.
Oh, was it a tribute to that?
Yeah. Okay. That happened the day previous. Yeah. So apparently it was a mark of respect for that.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I know that he got a lot of abuse, and I actually was someone that was shouting, why is he not celebrating against Chelsea? It wasn't because it was Chelsea. It was because apparently it's because of the terror attack.
Probably a bit of both. He eventually wants to come back to the as the Rogers way back up there.
Okay, I didn't know that, so I was just thinking it's not like you were a Chelsea legend or something like that. They're not gonna
I was going to say just before
upset if
just before you jumped in and started having throwing pelters at him. I'll save you that trouble.
Fair enough. I want to talk about Sturridge now. Obviously, he was at your club many, many years ago.
Yeah, another one that doesn't celebrate when he scores against Chelsea.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if he scored.
Well, on that point, is he completely done in terms of, is he now just a finisher? Because that dynamism that he had before, as well as being a deadly finisher,
yeah,
he just seems to offer now literally nothing apart from taking that one chance that he's... And he's not even taking that one chance anymore.
Yeah, it's hard for him. And I don't know exactly what is the cause, whether it's him getting older or him just not having that regular spin of games.
He's cold.
I think the regular spin of games will give him the some of the dynamism back. But Klopp clearly doesn't fancy him. He's not going to be first choice there. Mm. I think if he wants to go there and have a good finish to his career, he's got to try and get a move.
Mm.
He can, you know, cut his hair short or long or whatever it is, but if he really wants to do something, he's just got to go somewhere else.
Rabbit, do you agree? Is he not only done at Liverpool, but is he maybe done at the top level? Because I was watching him and he just offers now literally nothing apart from, he's probably still the best finisher at your club, but it seems to be that you need to supply him now with a lot of chances to get that finish to score that goal.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I look at things a little bit differently, slightly, just because I almost, because of my background of working for an agency, I sometimes think of the player and his, what's best for his career.
Mm.
So I look at Sturridge and I think, what do you actually want to achieve between now and the end of your season? Do you want to be a player slash squad player for a team who's in the top four in the Champions League every two, three times of 5-6 years?
Mm.
Or do you want to play week in, week out, injury permitting? And I sort of get the impression of him, because he's been at City, because he's been at Chelsea, now at Liverpool, that mentally, is he willing to take that drop down? I mentioned before about the Premier League, how I personally think it's, you've got your top four, top five with Spurs, you've got your Everton, and then you've got the
Leicester. You made them five as well. Decent. You're welcome back. Yeah. You're welcome back.
Top four and Spurs.
And then you've got the other 14 teams in the Premier League. He won't go Everton just simply because of Liverpool. I don't want to thought so anyway. So that leaves him with 14 other clubs who are trying to not get relegated and who are trying to be that Everton, or trying to get into the top four. Is he willing to go down and almost come up against Liverpool, Chelsea every other week and almost be in an inferior team? I'm not too sure. But then if he does go to that sort of a team, he will be the main man, mm-hmm. without question, because he's got the ability to put the ball in the back of the net. The problem at the moment is he hasn't got the ability to play week in, week out because of his injuries.
That's interesting, yeah. I think someone mentioned the pod last year about Sturridge, that he's in that weird ground of, he's probably not good enough anymore for a top five team, but he's probably too good for a West Ham or for a Southampton. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's that he can't let go of the fact that you're not good enough to be a top six team anymore, and you have to mentally accept now that...
But is he too good for those clubs at that level now? And I've been saying this, I just don't think he trusts, I'm not saying ability-wise, in the couple of seasons there when Suarez was around, he was as good as we had, but he doesn't trust his body anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it, that 10-yard burst of speed, burst of pace that he used to have, he doesn't go for that anymore. He kind of half pulls out of those balls in, and he never, ever wants to go in behind. I watched him for a couple of minutes during the game, just focused on him. He's always coming into the ball now, always just wants it, lay it off. So he's kind of getting involved in the play, but he's not really doing it in a threatening way like he was 4 or 5 years ago.
You know what sometimes he ends up doing? Yeah, he sometimes gets involved in play when he's not actually needed to.
Yeah.
Either.
But I think it's to look like he's busy, like he is actually kind of contributing something now, because he can't do what he was able to do 4 or 5 years ago. And I think if you're looking at, I always thought West Ham mightn't be a bad fit for him, like a London club that had gone into a ground, 50, and we know that hasn't quite worked out. But it was at the time it looked like it could be a progressive club, could be going places, mightn't have been a bad move for him. I don't know now whether West Ham have their own problems, but I'm not sure whether he'd fit in their side.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see him as being that man, even in a West Ham side, that's just give me the ball and I'll do something and I'll get. I don't think he has that level of ability anymore.
No.
Not purely because of just injuries and have just taken over his body, and he can't do the things he used to be able to do.
I tell you what though, I mean, it might sound crazy here, but Chelsea, we've got 2 strikers.
Mm.
If he was available for like 10 million or something, the 10 million is not in the stadium market, 20 million in January.
You take him.
I take a punt then.
Yeah.
I haven't, obviously, you'll probably go at the end of the
but
season.
But I thought it was, from a Liverpool's perspective, we might come on to kind of the kind of team formations and tactics, but I just can't understand how Solanke's not getting more game time. I think he's Sturridge from 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He might not quite have the same level of ability, but Sturridge is so the opposite of what Klopp wants in one of his forwards. He doesn't really shut down. He can't threaten in behind. He doesn't have that electric pace anymore. So he doesn't really fit any of the things that Klopp's looking for from a front player. Solanke kind of at least offers all of that.
Mm.
So I just thought it was and it didn't prove a disaster, but I just thought it was an odd, you brought this young kid in from Chelsea and you're not really giving him any game time. You've gone back to a guy that doesn't look like he can do what you want him to do.
Gee, did both managers bottle it? the lineup.
Yeah, I think so. I was disappointed. When I heard the Liverpool lineup first, and I was rubbing my hands together with glee. And when I heard Drinkwell was in our lineup, and I was like, "Oh goodness, But yeah,
never a bad game.
Did you think he had a good game?
I didn't think he had a bad game.
Oh, do you remember when Ox was just running left, right, and just left him for dead? No, you have to get a shot.
But you boys came to, you clearly came to City and soak it up and try and hit on the counter. And that's why you played three defensive midfielders.
I just don't see what he offers. And that's the thing. I won't say we deserve to win. I think a draw was a fair result.
Well, I'm glad your manager thought differently.
Well, of course he didn't say that. But going back to what he, and maybe alluding to what he said a bit, I actually just don't think now we are clinical enough to play in the way that Conte wants to play. Because there were opportunities in the first half or situations that if we take them, you've got the goal, you've got a lead, and maybe you can build on it. But Morata isn't quite there. He's not, dare I say it, Acosta.
I think that looks good up top for you. I think Hazard, Morata, I think that looks a really good combination.
You know what, it does. It looks good, but it's not as effective as maybe, you know, a Drogba or Acosta in the past.
Mm.
And then what happens is you have to put more forward and create more chances. And if you create more chances, they will score. But then you leave yourself open at a bit at the back. And I think Conte's really struggled this season finding that balance, and that's why a few games like we've conceded a few goals. When Fabregas is in there, you know, we look a bit lightweight, backwards, because defensively he's not so good. But when we're going forward, like he really does open up, and like playing in that kind of quarterback role. You saw when he came on,
he had a real big
impact. But I think he's always going to have that problem: do I play Fabregas and go for it, or do I play anyone else but Drinkwater and try and keep it tight?
Do you think that Christian playing now is Conte basically saying, this is the centre back that I really wanted, I'm going to phase out Luiz, or is Luiz just on the naughty step and he'll be back in the team in a few games time?
I think Luiz is on the naughty step, because ultimately I actually think for what we wanted to do in that game, Luiz probably would have been better in midfield than Drinkwater. This is not just Drinkwater decision. But it kind of is. But Luiz has actually got power. He's actually got a bit of like a bit more mobility, and he can actually ping a ball better than what, you know. Drinkwater just looked for Vardy. Vardy's not there, so what's he gonna do? So he can actually ping a ball around, which I think would actually be quite useful for our team. So I would have actually preferred Luiz being better.
But do you not think in a game where you'd clearly come to be very structured, very, very defensively sound, and make sure you didn't leave gaps, Luiz doesn't offer you. He doesn't offer you that.
But in
you'd have to. But I'm saying Liverpool's midfield all want to. When we get the ball, it's all about breaking forward. And there's runners going from everywhere, and I think to his credit, Drinkwater did track a lot of those runners back. Like, whereas
5 yards behind them.
Yep. I'm just saying. But he got there eventually. Luiz is still running around up top, thinking, "Oh."
I mean, maybe that's just me. I wanted to go and win. I think a draw helps nobody at this time of year, especially when City are 10 points clear. And I'm just not into this Man United go to places to get draws thing. Like, let's go and try and win games.
Well, on that point, Ravi, do you agree that your manager bottled it? And if you do agree that he bottled it, is that, why do you think they bottled it? Because as G says, City are going to run away with the league at the moment, and points don't help anybody at the moment. Or do you think he was just so worried about what happened in midweek psychologically, a loss to Chelsea, which could have happened, might have just done terminal damage for your whole season?
Yeah, I can imagine the what happened in midweek would have changed his mentality slightly, and the lineup that he did field. I think potentially what happened at Anfield against Man United may have played in his mind how defensive United did come, and how that game sort of panned out. So maybe he wasn't quite sure whether Conte was going to go completely Mourinho on him, or be a little bit more attacking, which I felt he was. So I don't think he bottled it. I think that we were 5 minutes away from getting 3 points.
You don't think he bottled it?
That lineup suggests that he bottled it. It wasn't his strongest lineup. He's at home. Chelsea are playing well, but they're not unbeatable Chelsea. I felt they both bottled it, but I thought more so Klopp being the home manager.
But when you say bottled it, what
I thought, he thought, I'm going to hold back a little bit here.
But we didn't change formation.
No, but he had a weaker team.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, you're saying he had to go for the win. The win was What, so you're saying he bottled it because he didn't go for a win?
Yeah.
But that would, I would suggest that the way you would, that is only quantified as if he changed his shape. So well, if we went five at the back and all of a sudden dropped in two defensive midfielders and we played one up top on his own and sat in and drew Chelsea on, that's not what actually happened in the game.
He played a fullback on the wing. Oxlade.
Thinking like, you know what I mean? That's like that, but that's not where the Ox should be playing and where he wants to play.
I think it's that going for Ox to Mane is defensive.
Yeah, maybe you could argue that he's more slightly more, but it's not like Mane doesn't track back. I mean, if you watch Liverpool every week, Mane works quite hard. I think he actually does get up
and
down.
Did Mane play in the midweek game?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I didn't think what I thought was odd about the formation is if you look at our, you know, Ravid's a Liverpool fan as well. When I look at our, and I think everyone knows, we're great up top and we look dodgy at the back. So after the Sevilla game, if you were looking at where the problems were in that Liverpool team, you would think the changes were going to be made at maybe left back, maybe at centre back, maybe your holding midfielder. Henderson doesn't look that suited to that role. Yet he changed his attacking kind of lineup where we're usually strong. So that's what I thought was a bit odd about the formation. But I don't think he bottled it or didn't go for the win. I felt we kind of controlled a lot of the game, to be quite honest.
Did any of you guys hear about the Liverpool fan, the blind Liverpool fan in midweek in the Liverpool game? Yeah, who is a blind Liverpool fan. He got really roughed up apparently by some of the Spanish police and they took away his cane. He had a really, really rough deal and he's complaining to the FA to do something about it. What do you think the FA, in incidences like that, can the FA do and what should the FA do? Because I was thinking about, it's all well and good complaining to the FA and saying, and he's right to complain to the FA, but I was thinking, what would I want the FA to do?
They essentially can't do anything. They'll make a complaint to the Spanish counterparts and say
we'll look into
it's unacceptable and they'll probably concur and say it is unacceptable but we don't have control over the Spanish police side.
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, obviously this was a terrible incident, but we saw what the Seville police did to the Tottenham fans. So let's not be too harsh on them. They've done good in the past. You know?
Yeah. But someone was saying to me that apparently the Seville firm are really one of the worst in Europe. Like people talk about the Russians and a lot of the French kind of quarters across that country, but apparently the Seville firm are kind of slyly one of the worst in European football. I didn't know that. And just finally, is this another big game that has flattered to deceive?
I think so.
I can't think of one big game this season so far.
I didn't think that was a bad game at the weekend.
I don't think it was a bad game, but I don't think it was a game I'm going to remember.
Yeah. No, but I sometimes think you need to back up. You can't get caught up in the Sky Sports hype.
No, forget that. You know, as a game of football, do you remember three really good chances? Good goals.
Yeah, but sometimes
chances.
That's not all. I thought there was some good, lively, quick football played in that game. Good, expansive attacking football from both sides.
I thought there was two.
That, you know, when you look at it, I didn't come away from that thinking, wow, that's an hour and a half. And there have been games this season. Liverpool United was absolutely awful to look at.
I can't think of one that's been good.
I genuinely didn't think that was a bad game at the weekend. Not that you're going to remember it in 10 years' time, but, you know, I think we over, sometimes things get overhyped because of the Sky Sports world and we build these top six clashes into something they're not. We should maybe just appreciate them for, it was a decent game of football.
But I'm seeing Hazard on the pitch, Coutinho on the pitch, Morata on the pitch, I'm seeing some good and some very good players on the pitch. I just didn't think it lived up to the players that were on the pitch.
Yeah, what do you think though? What do you want then?
I want a game where there's three or four really good goal scoring chances considering the attacking talent on the pitch. And I can't remember three really good attacking chances or goal scoring chances.
Well, there's two goals scored, so apart
from that,
well, Drinkwater was in for one. It was bad touch.
Made sure to tread on the ball, didn't he?
No, I think there were some. I think we actually
on
the counter had some really good situations. I remember there was a few crosses that if the cross is just right or the pass is just right, the final ball, then you're in. And you get that a lot more than the glaring chances nowadays in big football matches.
Yeah, they're good to fit. I know our back four gets a bit of a rough ride. But we've had a pretty decent defensive record at Anfield, away from home, not so much. But at Anfield, it's so coming to defence, you know, defences are allowed to turn up and play as well.
No, I take your point. It wasn't a bad game. I just didn't think it was particularly.
Yeah, but I think that's it, Jordan, now that people have become more cowardly in terms of football. Like you said, I mean, I think the lineups for me both said conservatism,
mm-hmm.
and I'd just like to see a few teams just going for it. Mm-hmm. Go back to Kevin Keegan. Just go try and batter. And the thing is,
I wish we'd go the other way. That's our actual problem, is we don't have a way of shutting up. We're 3-0 up away from home in a Champions League game, and we're still all open, flying forward. That we're actually the opposite of what you're saying. I really wish every now and again we could put the brakes on a game and just slow it down and just go, right, actually, when we were 1-0 up, a normal top 6 team, top 4 team, whatever you want to say,
yeah.
in those big games, if that was Mourinho, heaven forbid, that was in charge of Liverpool, well, I guarantee you, but I will say there'd be a 1-0 win. As soon as we went 1-0 up, he'd have shut up shop, there'd have been a bit of cynicism, and you'd have held on to your 1-0 win.
Yeah.
We cannot do that.
Maybe so, I'm going to put more on Conte. I just think Fabregas should have started. I think Fabregas should have started, or came on earlier than what he did. It was clear that it wasn't work. Like, I think for 20 minutes in the second half was probably your
especially the run you've been on as well.
Yeah,
like you've had a bit of momentum coming into the game.
Just go for it.
Could have gone for it.
Be what, 8 points or 11 points behind? Try and get the win. Mm. Try and like take it by the scruff of the neck. And I just don't think we went for it, apart from when we went down and then we threw all people on to try to make sure we didn't lose. I just think a bit of that endeavour a bit earlier on might have had a dip. I'm not going to say we Mourinho did, because there was still that element of trying to win throughout the game. There was a way, there was an avenue to win. It wasn't like we were just 10 men behind the ball and balls up to Lukaku. We actually did try to have a system where we could win. But I think sometimes, like second half, 50th minute, 60th minute, turn the screw on a bit, like go for it, like try to. And I just felt that we waited until we were behind to do that. So for me, it was a little bit disappointing.
I don't know how Ravi felt, but I think from a Liverpool perspective, the disappointing thing was when we went 1-0 up, we kind of fell away, we stopped playing. All the things that we'd done controlling the game for the previous 60 minutes. 65 minutes.
Wow.
We stopped doing those and kind of we drew Chelsea on
because
we
couldn't make his substitution or his tactical change at time. That's why.
Just a final point to wrap it. Do you feel like City are going to win this league just by the rivals taking points off each other? Because I was working it out and I was like, well, Arsenal beat Tottenham, Tottenham beat Liverpool. Liverpool be who have you beaten this year?
Arsenal, mate.
Arsenal. Do you know what I mean? United.
Forgot that one, Jud.
I did, yeah. They're just taking points off each other, whereas City are just beating everybody.
Yeah. Are Arsenal one of the rivals?
We're in the top six, mate. We're in the top six. Notice top six, not top four. I said this. Top six.
I think you're fourth.
We're fourth now, but we're probably a top six team. But do you just think that the fact that everyone's taking points off each other is going to doubly help City by the fact they're just beating everybody anyway?
Yeah, I think it's a side story. It's just probably a bit of a coincidence. But first and foremost, plain fact is they're the best team in the league.
Yeah,
they're playing the best brand of football. Arguably got the best manager. I know Salah is up there, but I think De Bruyne is at this moment in time the best player in the league.
Mm.
When you put all them together, you're destined to not only be top of the table at this stage of the season, but they should go on and win it. Yeah.
All right, it's been one now, guys. We're going to do something every week until Christmas. I want to get you guys' this goal of the weekend. So I've called it the Christmas Cracker of the Weekend, only because I couldn't think of a title. It was Christmas, and I had about 10 minutes before you guys came to think of a title. My goal of the weekend was Harry Kane's goal for Tottenham. I'll tell you why. It was a very simple, deft finish that he does quite a lot. But I like the fact that when Tottenham need their main man to step up and score a goal, more often than not, he does that. And although it seemed like a very simple finish, I thought, do you remember the goal? Do you remember the goal he scored?
Yeah.
I thought it's sort of a chance that certain strikers would go under their feet or they'd put it back towards where it came from. It was a very deft finish that I've seen him do before and I liked it. That was my goal of the weekend. Ravi, what was yours?
Funnily enough, I'm going to go with William.
Okay.
And the reason I say this is because I'm sure between the four of us, half will probably say it was a cross, half will say he actually meant it. But I think, obviously, because he came off the bench, but more so, I've been in that position when you're in goal and someone goes for a cross And it just, because it's come out of nowhere. So you, as much as I criticise Mignolet till the cows come home, and I don't think he's a good goalkeeper, and I'm somewhere down the line I'm going to say he was to blame for the goal. There was a point of that cross where he would have expected it to obviously go to his right, and there's going to be that 1 millisecond where it's taking a change of direction, it's gone over him, and he got a touch on it, but it was just too much.
You're being well generous there. He didn't
play the Mignolet for that.
Mignolet?
Yeah.
He didn't move until it was in the net.
Oh no, that's harsh.
Oh, come on. I swear to God, if I was anywhere near him when he went in, anywhere near him. Stop.
At the time,
outrageous I was goalkeeping. Wow. If it happened at the other end, Courtois would have just caught it. He'd have caught it, and then Chelsea would have been attacking.
I texted a couple of goalkeepers as soon as it happened, and they both said, and they both are not fans of Mignolet, they both said, nah, he's just been caught. That's a freak. Mm. And I agree. You know, I
mean, he makes me so mad. I swear to God.
Right, anyway, smooth boy. G, what was your goal of the weekend?
Stephen's pissed.
I should just vote for William as well. But I'm going to go for Sigurdsson. Against Southampton, it ended up being a losing goal and counted not for much. But at the same time, sometimes it's good to see a player when they're out of form, like, you know, really step up to the plate. I feel Sigurdsson got a bit of a harsh stick, really, because he's been brought into a team that has been totally dysfunctional. Mm. And there's no... He needs an outlet. He needs fast players running off him. He needs a striker that he can hit. And he just doesn't have that.
Mm.
So, it was nice to see him get a goal. I think he's a good player. And I hope... Well, I'm not really too fussed about Everton, but I like him as a player, so I hope he gets to improve and go on and do better things this season.
We'll talk Everton a little bit later in the pod. Stephen, what was your goal of the weekend?
Well, you didn't specify when you said you asked for these earlier that it had to be a Premier League goal.
Oh, no, I think he's got one out of the Premier League.
The best goal I've seen this week was Jordan Kluivert's for Ajax's second goal.
I saw that tweeted, actually, yeah.
Absolute worldie. Yeah. Like, gets on the halfway line, runs, beats two men, cuts inside and hits a rocket.
Yeah.
As part of a hat-trick at 18 years of age, so he looks like he could be a decent player.
Someone tweeted, I remember, saying it was one of the greatest hat-tricks they'd ever seen.
Even his third goal, I'm saying I went for his second goal, but his third goal was a great... I mean, Roda were dead in their feet, but he steps in, does him with a double step over and rolls in, just passes it into the bottom corner. He looks a talent.
Right, gentlemen, let's talk about Crystal Palace. We've not talked about them since the start of the season, and to do so, I'm going to bring in Jim, who is the host of FYP fanzine Dive Year Plan. How are you doing, Jim?
I'm good. Thanks very much for having me.
No, cheers for coming on, man. Good result for your boys on the weekend. Have you seen enough from Roy Hodgson to believe that you'll be in the Premier League next season?
We've certainly seen an improvement, definitely. I mean, not that that was difficult, given how bad we were at the start of the season. I mean, 7 games and 7 defeats, no goals is... It's very Palace in that way, that we never do things in halves. If we're going to be bad, we're going to be very, very bad. And we were record-breakingly bad. So what has not really been difficult for Roy to be an improvement on that, to be honest. He only had to get the team playing slightly better and scraping a few points together. And that's exactly what he's done. But his point average since he came in has been good enough, I think, over the course of the season to probably stay up. Okay. So in that regard, yes. But obviously, you know, there's a long way to go.
Indeed. Do you think, Jim, your board are competent? Because I was doing a little bit of research and I've seen you've had 11 managers in 5 years. Now, that's just beyond embarrassing. And that says to me that this is not about players on the pitch. This is about a board that just have no plan or are really bad at identifying good managers.
Yeah, that's definitely an argument. And there are lots of fans that do believe that. I mean, you have to caveat that with the fact that three or four of those managers walked out on the club. You know, Tony Pulis walked out on us. Sam Allardyce quit football, in theory. Dougie Friedman left us to go to Bolton. So they've been unlucky with some managers, but it is a high turnover. Yeah, it is. We interviewed Julian Speroni for our fanzine recently, and he's kicked out 17 different managers at Crystal Palace, which I think is pretty crazy. Yeah, so I understand that point. But I do think Palace have been unlucky.
Do you think you've got a Premier League team there? Because, again, I was looking through your team at the start of the season, and to me, it smacks of a Championship
team. I just don't see enough quality in that team to suggest that you're, you know, you're good enough to be in the Premier League. Am I just being harsh, or do you think that's a very good Championship team?
I mean, I would disagree with that. I actually think it's probably the best first 11, certainly, the number of scores that I've seen at Palace in my lifetime. I think it's got absolute quality throughout that team. You know, even I know we don't own Loftus-Cheek, but he's been an improvement this season on the team last year. And you know, last year under Allardyce, that team absolutely flew towards the back end of the season, and they were getting crazy results, beating Chelsea, beating Arsenal, beating Liverpool, and everyone was saying if we'd had Allardyce for the whole of the season, we'd be finishing top 10, no problem.
But Jim, I definitely think
it's got the quality to stay up there, but as you guys know, it's not always about quality on players. It's about so much more than that. You know, team cohesion and organisation, and we clearly, for the first few games of the season, just didn't have that. And doesn't matter how good your team is, if you haven't got those basics, you're going to struggle.
No, yeah. Recent home draws with West Ham and Everton, who were both struggling themselves, are they the kind of games that you think you need to be, you know, getting at least 4 points from if you're going to have any chance of pulling away from the bottom three?
Yeah, oh, definitely, absolutely, and really, we should have had 3 points in both those games. We were terrible in the first half against West Ham, and then we battered them second half, and Joe Hart turned into Manuel Neuer, and you know, I don't know how, and he was brilliant second half. We pulled it out of the bag with Wilf getting a last-minute goal, and then against Everton, I'm sure you guys have seen, you know, we were robbed, really, of the first goal. It was never a penalty. It was definitely a dive. And the second goal, Speroni and Dan have contrived to hand them the ball back, but otherwise they had no other chances, you know, and we battered them as well. So we've definitely been unlucky, but you're right. Those are the games. You know, when you're down there, even when you're not down there, even if you're pushing for mid-table play, you have to win those games, definitely. And we've played well enough, but we haven't been getting the rub of the green. And Stoke on Saturday was the first time where we actually got a bit of luck with a last-minute goal, you know, goes across the box and Saka is there to poke it in. And I feel like maybe the tide and the luck might be starting to turn for us, hopefully.
You've got a big game against your rivals, Brighton, next week. Why do you hate them so much?
That's a great question. And I do understand, for anyone outside of Brighton and Palace, this is a bizarre rivalry. I get it, and I understand why people don't understand it, because we're, you know, 45 miles away from each other. We've got no connection between, you know, South London and Brighton. It doesn't make sense. But if you've been brought up as a Palace fan or a Brighton fan, you are told from an early age to hate Brighton or hate Palace. It's in your blood. It's in your DNA. That's just the way it is, in the same way Arsenal and Tottenham fans have grown up to hate of a Liverpool and Man United fans. You just are. You don't question it. You know, and I've grown up to learn that it's obviously stemmed from the late 70s, and they played each other five times in one season, and Venables and Mullery, the managers, and they hated each other at Spurs, and then they hated each other as managers, and there were various things that happened. They got promoted together, and they got relegated together, and there was fights in the streets of Brighton, fights in the streets of Croydon. There were all these things coming together, a perfect storm that made it this rivalry seemingly out of nothing. And that, despite, you know, not playing each other for years and years in the 80s and then in the 90s and 2000s, and Palace waiting and waiting in the Premier League for Brighton to come and join us. You know, they keep bottling promotion year after year. Finally, you know, they didn't. it's just one of these things. It just now is a thing, and it always will be, regardless of, you know, how many times we play them. And you know, it's the first Premier League meeting between the two clubs. We've only played in the top flight four times ever in our history. That was in 79 and 80. And we lost three of those games and drew the other. So actually, if we win on Tuesday, we make history by beating them for the first time ever in the top flight. So that, added to the fact that it's Brighton and added to the fact that we are still bottom of the league, makes this a massive, massive game for Palace.
Just briefly, who's more likely to stay up out of the two clubs, hand on heart? Or hand on head, shall I say?
Hand on heart, or which
one
do you want?
Yeah, forget the heart.
Hand on heart, Palace, obviously. Hand on head, I still think Palace. I genuinely do. We've got Premier League quality. Well, we've got Premier League quality. We've also got Premier League experience in our squad. These players know how long the season is and what it takes to battle through. And I believe Brighton, yes, they've had a good start, and fair play to them, but if you look at the quality in their squad compared to the quality in our squad, I don't think there's any comparison. And they've got Glenn Murray scoring goals for them, and, you know, God bless him, he's a Palace legend, we love him, and he's doing very well at Brighton at the moment, but he's not going to do that all season, you know, and we do have players and the quality, I think, to turn it around, and we are hopefully, as I said, starting to see that. So maybe my heart...
I think they've got a better manager, though, Jim.
I do think that we all stay up, and I do think that they all get dragged.
Well, Jim's
that's my honest appraisal.
Jim, Steve's just here saying that he reckons he thinks they've got a better manager than you, and that might ultimately be the difference.
They've got a younger manager than us. You know, I'll give him that. He's definitely younger. Whether he's better or not, I think he's getting a lot of respect for Chris Hughton. I think he's a really good manager. You know, I like him a lot. And but yeah, we've got Roy. Roy's an experienced manager, very experienced. He's a nice old chap. You know, I've met him a few times. He's a nice, very nice guy. Whether he's the right manager for Palace going forward, who knows? But we've got him now. We're always in this situation, Palace, where we're trying to turn things around and, you know, recover. And he's the latest guy to be there. And we just have to pack him at the moment. And actually, I think when you're in a dogfight, you know, if you look at his record at West Brom, his record at Fulham, he does know what he's doing when you're down there. And he has got history on his side. So maybe for now, he is the better manager for us. But, you know, I definitely hear what you're saying about Hughton. I think he's a bright young manager. So, you know, all the best to him, but obviously not on Tuesday.
No, I just listened to you talk there, Jim, and I agree. I think Palace do have some very good Premier League talent, especially going forward. But then does that not back up the point that maybe Roy isn't the man? Because at the moment, he hasn't turned that talent into as many points as you probably would have hoped at this stage. Whereas Hughton at Brighton, obviously with inferior players, as you say, at the moment is getting a better tune out of them, isn't he?
Yeah, true. But then, you know, sometimes when you get promoted, you have that momentum, don't you, from coming up that takes you into the start of the season. We saw it with Huddersfield this season. We've seen it with teams in the past. You know, Blackpool, remember them being brilliant for the first half of the season back in, maybe it was 2010, and then they fell apart, you know. So I do understand where you're coming from, yeah. And the most frustrating thing at Palace is we've had this squad now for a couple of seasons, and it is a really good squad, and we haven't seemed to been able to get the best out of it consistently. And that's not just been Roy, although I genuinely do think Roy is turning it around. We are seeing an improvement, but you know, that was Pardew, that was Allardyce, you know, going back before that, Neil Warnock struggled, you know. So I mean, not that I'm putting Neil Warnock in the same quality bracket as those guys, but that's been a frustration for Palace. Yeah, you've hit on it there. Is we feel like we are going backwards every season. We should be progressing with this squad. We should be going to the top 10, you know, we should be absolutely pushing on, and we're not. And there are teams like Brighton who at the moment are getting better out of smaller squads and less talented players, and that is the big conundrum for Palace. And if we stay up, which I think we will, then it'll be the same question in the summer. How do you actually take a squad like this and actually improve it and make it play to the best of its abilities? Because in the last 3 or 4 years, we've not been doing that, and we keep coming around to the same thing again.
Jim, you wasn't putting your hand on your head at all there, but we'll take it anyway. Listen, Jim, where can people find Dive Year Plan?
So if you find us on Twitter and Facebook, it's just at FYP Fanzine. We've got a podcast as well, which is on Audio Boom and all the other places as well. So, and YouTube as well, which is FYP TV. So pretty much everywhere.
Wicked. Jim, cheers for coming on, mate. Thanks for your time, mate.
Thanks, guys. Cheers. Take care.
Let's move on now, gentlemen. Let's talk about Everton. Bloody hell.
You've got two Liverpool fans on this week.
It should be fine. Ravi, what the hell's going on, Everton? What is going on? What is going on? I couldn't even think of a snazzy or a creative question other than what is going on?
I didn't see the game yesterday, but I saw the result, and I was, part of me was surprised, but then part of me wasn't. And then when I actually looked at the results since he's sort of taken over, I noticed that it's 20 goals conceded in 7 games.
Yeah, they've lost seven of nine games under him.
But it was the goals conceded which concerned me more, because wasn't Unsworth a defender? Because surely, even if you're not a defender and you're going through such a poor time, go in, it's a cliche, get the basics right. Start from the back, work your way forward. But even more so as a defender who's, you know, mentally, during your playing career, you've been thinking defensively. You know, your first thought isn't, I'm going to put the ball in the back of the net, I'm going to keep it out. So surely when you go into a club like Everton, a club that you know very well because of your playing background, etc., and all the issues that are going on with them, surely you go, first day on the training ground, right lads, keeping a clean sheet next week. And then you think 20 goals conceded in 7 games. No clean sheet, I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that over that period of time. I just can't get it. That's what would concern me first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, G, the answer is to get someone in short term now to just basically just end this talk of possibly going down? or do they now need to start thinking long term? Get the guy that they want, who's going to be here for 3-4 years, and pay whatever's necessary.
Isn't that what Unsworth is meant to be doing?
The long term.
No, the short term guy until they get the.
Well, I think they might have thought that, but they've been like, wow, we didn't think you'd be with a guy, but you're really bad. So do they need to kind of get a short term guy just to settle the ship and keep them up this year? Because that's the objective now. Or go for someone that might take them down, yeah, but might also keep them up and be here 3 years' time.
I think they should have just gone for the Juggalo and gone for Silva. I know Watford are saying they won't release him, but money talks. If you pay the money, you'd have got him. There's always a problem with an interim manager where people know they're interim. It's better actually to get someone in, from what I've seen, call them permanent and then just sack them.
As a fan of a club that has done
that. Bobby Di Matteo was a prime example, won the Champions League. it's better to just give someone a job than to say interim manager, because you saw what happened with Rafa Benitez, right? It just undermines you. If the fans don't like you, they're more willing to get on your back, because they'll say, well, you're going at the end of the season, and they'll give you more sticks.
And so, the players have clearly, because there was the Schneidlin and Morales walking off the training ground incident, so the players clearly haven't bought into him at all, have they?
Yeah, usually in situations like this, the coach has been the nice guy in the dressing room, the manager's been the bad guy, the coach has been the nice guy, so it'll be fine, oh, the nice guy's in charge, like that, you know, shaky guy at Leicester. but in this occasion, Unsworth just seems to mess up. And the thing is, he comes after every defeat, he comes out and says, this is a disgrace, this is not good enough for Everton, it hurts me. It kind of leaves the players out in the lurch. I remember there was one game where he pretty much dropped all the new players that had been bought and went back to the old, and he still lost. You know what I mean? Everything he's done has just turned gone worse. I don't know that he could stay there now. I think he has to go. But yeah, sorry, with diversion. Back to your point, I think that ultimately they just need to go and find the best manager for themselves. I understand that they've reopened talks with Allardyce. I mean, you spoke earlier about Palace kind of not really having a plan. What the hell is Everton's plan? How do you go from Allardyce to Silva? It's just totally chalk and cheese. They clearly haven't got any type of cohesion or plan at the top of that club now. And it's one of those days where I've done it with Mike Ashley, I've done it now with the Everton owners, where I say, thank God for Roman. Because as much as Roman gets criticised, at least there seems to be a plan to his madness. I can't see any plan at Everton.
And the thing is, the reason why Everton are in trouble now, because if Allardyce is the guy, they approached him before.
Yeah.
And I think the problem there was apparently they wanted him on a short-term basis. And he was like, no, give me the job properly, otherwise don't bother. He now knows they've offered Silva 10 million.
Yeah.
So Allardyce can now say, well, I want at least 10 million because I know that you've got it to pay. And the terms are on his, he holds the power now because he knows you've come back to me now, so I know how desperate you are.
It just makes them look silly.
It does make them look really weak. Stephen, Everton have got West Ham next. Who do you fear for more this season out of those two clubs?
Probably still West Ham.
Why?
As you know, I live local to West Ham. I got a lot of West Ham mates. I've been over to the ground a couple of times. The whole atmosphere around the club is toxic, and I don't think it's been solved by appointing Moyes. I think the big problem there is the board, and I think as long as that board exists at West Ham, they're not going to progress as a club in terms of moving up the table, and the fans just don't buy into them. So as long as you've got that toxic mix, unless Moyes does something really spectacular on the pitch, and they shift up that table quickly and a long way, I think there's going to be that kind of toxic atmosphere around the club pretty much for the rest of the season. Whereas Everton, I think the fans are still on board with the club at least. They like Bill Kenwright. He's been a good owner in the past. So if they could get their appointment right, I think Everton could change things around quite quickly.
Do you agree, Ravit? Do you think that of the two clubs, West Ham are probably still the club you think have got bigger problems? Or do you think the fact they've at least got a manager in play, they got their first point under him on the weekend, you think that their ship is further down the line of being steadied as opposed to Everton, who at the moment are in just chaos?
Yeah, because I think West Ham as a club off the pitch don't seem to have it clued up. I think Steve's right with regards to the board. The fans aren't sure what's sort of going on. There still seems to be a transition with the stadium, which it shouldn't be by this time. And I think even with Moyes as an appointment, when you've got so much about a club going wrong, whether it's players, whether it's the engagement between fans, the board itself, why would you then bring in a manager who's got his own problems in terms of his last couple of experiences as manager? Because you're almost, you're putting the fate of the club and the Premier League survival in the hands of a man who, it's just, he's trying to find himself, let alone the club trying to find themselves.
But that's one of the things that the fans, because I was at the Liverpool West Ham game, which was obviously Bilic's last game, and all the talk before that game amongst the West Ham fans was that unless he got a win, and even if he got a win, he was possibly going to be done by the Monday anyway, and that Moyes was going to be the man. They were furious about that because they look at that as it was a cheap option by the board. He didn't cost them anything. They had no ambition to go out and pay money to get a Marco Silva. So actually, not only did he have problems from his previous jobs, the fact that he's come on a free is another thing that's annoying the West Ham fans, because they just don't feel that the club's prepared to push the boat out. And they're paying more money for their tickets. So, you know, you're bringing in all this extra revenue from the new ground. They don't feel they're seeing that being put back into the club by the owners. That was the general impression I got when I think. So it's kind of even just appointing Moyes on a free counts against the board. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a really, really horrible atmosphere down there. I mean, I was saying they're fighting amongst themselves. They're not too sure. There's no one direction amongst the fans. And I've read a couple of articles where they're kind of saying, as fans at least, we've got to kind of unite in some way, because if we're divided, the club's definitely going nowhere. The board's doing their thing. A lot of the players don't look that interested. We're not overly sold on the manager. And we're all fighting amongst ourselves. We don't really know what we want as a club. I think there's massive problems. West Ham. It hurts me to say I have a soft spot for West Ham, but I think they're in big trouble. West Ham.
The interesting thing with Moyes is at the time, if you actually think about the two clubs and where they're at, you could probably argue a better case. I mean, I might, I don't know about you boys, a better case for Moyes if he's going to go to either club, to go to Everton, just because that's where he's been before. He knows the club. He knows everything about it.
It's the one place he's done well.
Preston
to get the Everton job.
Okay, well, Premier League. Yeah. Premier League of that level. And of that caliber.
Everton's best years in the Premier League have been under him. But
some of their worst years as well. Just don't put that in there.
So you would think, okay, if it's going to be one of the two clubs that he go for, it'll be Everton. But correct me if I'm wrong, but was there any interest from Everton to go back to Moyes?
I think Ken Wright, when they initially sacked Koeman, floated the idea of bringing back Moyes. I think Moyes, from what I'm told, he wasn't interested. The fans, the majority, weren't interested either. So I think that kind of got poo-pooed really quickly.
We moved on to West Ham there. I think Everton, we're talking about managers being a problem and no plan in terms of whether it's Allardyce or whoever. I think generally the way Everton's been run is seems slightly chaotic behind the scenes. There's a lot of people that are escaping some blame here. I mean, Steve Walsh was specifically brought in behind recruitment. Ronald Koeman's taken a lot of flack for that kind of recruitment policy in the summer. Actually, they brought in a director of football who had a big reputation coming from Leicester. He's taken all the credit for your Mahrezes and Kantes. And they don't have a striker. So he spent that much money to be left playing Calvert-Lewin up top on his own. You know, they look really light when you look. We thought they made a lot of good signings. Pickford's, Michael Keane looked a sensible signing. Actually, now when you look at their squad, you think, wow, you've left yourself really light in key positions. And it goes back to that thing we're always saying, these kind of directors of football, I can understand why managers in this country have a problem with them, because the manager carries the can when results don't work out. This director of football seems to be able to float around in the background and kind of escape any blame or any kind of censure. And Bill Kenwright, I know he's been a great owner in the past and a good chairman, and the Everton fans have a lot of love for him. But he's involved in that structure at the moment. He employed Koeman, he employed Steve Walsh. They've put David Unsworth in charge at the moment, and all them decisions have been bad ones. Kind of to direct it all at Ronald Koeman and to direct it all at lazy players, I think it's a lazy option.
Well, we did discuss about 2 months ago on the pod, when we were talking about Everton. I asked, I think it was Joel at the time,
If Koeman has to go, because at the time Koeman was struggling, if Koeman has to go, should by consequence Steve Walsh go as well? Because if we're saying that Koeman, the players are not playing very well and the signings are not doing very well, then should Steve Walsh take some responsibility for that as well? Because his job is recruitment. If the people that are recruited are not doing well, he should take a lot of the blame for that. But just on Everton as well, I get the feeling, and I mentioned it to we had Ryan from West Ham Fan TV on the pod a few weeks ago, G. And there's a lot of parallels between Everton and West Ham. It seems a very, very comfy Everton in that they're the sort of club that they'll give an ex-player a job. There's a lot of ex-pros, working at Everton, and the Everton fans, like the West Ham fans, I hear them often talking about, we want one of our own. We want one of our own guys manager. We want a West Ham guy. We want an Everton guy. We want someone that gets the club. And I just thought, it's all well and good having an Everton guy in, but if the guy's crap, the guy's crap.
Yeah.
Do you feel that Everton, there's a culture that's a bit too comfy in terms of having these Everton legends come back when really they're letting their heart overrule their head?
Yeah, I mean, they know.
Do you know what I mean, Stephen?
It just makes me laugh when I hear that, because, you know, West Ham, one of their greatest ever superstars, Trevor Brooking, took them down. But, you know.
Well, yeah, we want an Everton guy, we want a West Ham guy, and I just think,
There is a lot of sentiment in there, especially, I mean, you mentioned the coaches, so you've got Unsworth,
Big
I think
Dunk.
Doug
Big Dunk there,
right?
Is there,
right?
Yeah.
There's another one there as well, someone reminded me.
I think Tony Hibbert's still floating around there somewhere.
Jesus. There's a few there.
Yeah, and it hasn't, I mean, I guess they would say that it hasn't really brought them anything negative. They've always kind of been quite comfortable in the Premier League, a few scrapes of relegation, but generally speaking, they've been there or thereabouts, like kind of mid-table. But when you want to get to that next level, you learn quickly that sentiment counts for nothing.
Mm.
And if they're going to that, then the first thing they might have to do is get rid of Ken Wright. There's going to be a lot of sentiment in that. So, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Be brutal.
But I do think sometimes we look at a lot of continental clubs, Bayern Munich, Ajax, they do bring back a lot of ex-players that come in and fulfil roles. But it feels, these guys come back with particular skill sets.
And I think that those clubs will pick the players rather than Everton. It seems like if you're a former player, you can just rock up one day and be like, I need a job. Can I get a coaching job?
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's kind of, if you're coming back and you have a skill set and you can fulfill a role within the club and you're a value, these clubs absolutely want you. And I think it's a good idea that people that do get the club and the fans have some connection to, that will work. But yeah, you have to say at the moment, like, what does Duncan Ferguson? I watched yesterday's game. He was kind of just sitting on the bench, shaking his head. He never. There didn't seem to be any real communication with Unsworth.
And there was a bit where Joel Royal came down after the second or third goal.
Yeah.
Spoke to Unsworth, and you thought, that doesn't look good. He might come down with some good words and advice, but it just didn't look good.
Call him.
It just looked a little bit like a little boy that needs help from his dad.
There doesn't look like there's that communication on the Everton bench, where just from the couple of games I've been watching it just in the last few weeks, whereas you watch the Liverpool Chelsea game at the weekend, those two benches together were in communication with their assistants non-stop during that game. It shows a kind of a real cohesive team unit in some squads, and I kind of looked at that and I really think to myself, I don't see, unless it's clearly happening on the training ground and we can't see it, I don't see what Duncan Ferguson was bringing to that yesterday when you're been smashed 5-1 away from home again.
He's a legend.
I know, but I'm sure, and that's great for Everton fans, but if you're relegated, then you lose your legendary status. Very good.
You mentioned Bayern Munich. If you're bringing back Beckenbauer or someone like that, then fair enough, but who the hell is Unsworth?
Now, come on that point, I don't think it necessarily matters whether you were. No. You could be I'm sure there are clubs that have like minor stars that play for them that have come and done a good job. I don't think it has to be, you have to have been the biggest player in the world to come back and contribute to the club. That's harsh.
If you're going to give someone
look at Nicky Butt.
If you're going to give someone a meaningless job, at least let him be one of the biggest names in football.
But he's not a meaningless job. I mean, he's meant to be, he's kind of almost acting as an assistant. Is he the assistant manager at the moment?
Who's that?
Duncan Ferguson.
No, I think he's the head of the under-18s, I think. I think he's the manager of the under-18s.
But the head of the manager of the under-18s wouldn't be sitting on the bench for a Premier League game.
Maybe first team coach. I don't know, but
what I'm saying is he's first team coach for assistant manager.
I thought it was striker coach, wasn't he? Something like that.
Heading coach, probably.
I mean, maybe I think he's kind of like you've got a reasonable role within a Premier League squad. That's fair. That's not a kind of a throwaway job. Look after my under 16s and my under 18s, which is still an important job. But to be involved with your first team and
you've got to be
100% sure about what he's bringing to the party. For
I think this is bringing his Everton tattoo.
I think it's a little bit part of the problem that Everton have got. Like we're bringing off all these names who are associated with the club, and we mentioned comfort zone, and that is very comfortable, bringing ex-players in. But I thought this summer was with the investment that's coming with Koeman. It was meant
to break that apart, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was supposed to get out of that comfort zone with Steve Walsh as well. But it seems that as a club, Everton don't know what they want to do. Do they want to remain this sentimental club in a little bit of a comfort zone? That I think we can all agree Everton is almost renowned as being that community club as well. Probably more so than Liverpool at times, just because of the way that how big we are in comparison.
Was that a slice shot there?
It wasn't meant to be, but if it comes out that way, then so be it. And I think maybe even Everton now are finding the transition from going from a sentimental community club to
a ruthless business that kind of makes the hard decisions. Yeah,
isn't as easy as maybe they all thought it would be.
Do you think the problem with just to kind of throw it out there, like Mashiri obviously taking over and was apparently the guy with all the money and he was going to make all this happen, but then there's been these kind of behind the scenes talk that actually it's maybe is it Usmanov, the Arsenal?
Yeah, he's got some involvement there,
and that you know that he's actually tied up in a lot of ways with Mashiri, and that maybe he's thinking of eventually moving. Whether that's actually Mashiri's actually a bit of a lame duck owner, if that was the case, kind of thing. So he doesn't have the kind of control over the club that you'd probably want from someone with that kind of level of, or the level of finance that people thought he was going to be bringing to the job.
Yeah, maybe. I've not thought of that. A couple more points and I'll move on, guys. I mean, first of all, Southampton, when they can't score two goals against anybody. So when they're scoring four against you, you know you're in like big, big trouble. There's one name that's not been linked with the Everton job, and I really don't understand why. And it's who I think would be perfect for that job. It's Eddie Howe. Eddie Howe, for me, should be getting that job. He fulfills ticks so many boxes for Everton. He's English. He's a good age. He's proven, unlike Pardew, that he can come through really bad runs and turn it around. He
Pardew plays a kind of well brand pitching of football. Himself up for the job yesterday.
Don't even start me on that.
I think it's unbelievable.
Don't even start me on that one. And you notice how on Sky...
He done everything but wear a suit with an Everton badge ironed onto it. It's unbelievable.
Don't even go there. But I just think Eddie Howe should be considered for that job. He plays a good brand of football that Everton fans say they want. Their main beef with Allardyce is that he doesn't play good football. Eddie Howe's team plays good football. I just think that no one's linked Eddie Howe that job. Is that because the start of the season wasn't so good? And the time that Koeman was struggling, he wasn't doing very well as well. So they maybe thought he's not the answer. Or do you think that he should be a viable candidate for that job? I just find it weird that no one's mentioned Eddie Howe.
I think the way that...
He won't be expensive to get out of his contract at Bournemouth.
The way that they started Bournemouth, obviously coinciding with the start of the Everton
match, yeah.
I had my doubts
of
how I thought, let's see if he can turn it around. To be fair to him, he has.
I think they're ninth now or something. Yeah. You know?
So he's obviously done well to turn it around. But I think the appointment of Howe, I'd look at that and I'd say, okay, that's not disrespecting Eddie Howe, but I'd look at that and I'd say, okay, that's the old Everton. That's an old Everton appointment. That's not a Koeman. That's not a former manager that they can go and get.
You think they want a big name?
I think so. I think considering what they've done over the summer, the amount of money that they've spent, to go from Koeman down to Howe, I think it would just be, not in terms of quality, but it would just be almost going back to the old...
A lesser name,
old Everton.
Fair enough. He did mention pre-season when he spent all that money that he wanted to kind of bring in a big-name manager or have a big-name manager to compete with other guys in the Northwest. So obviously Klopp, Pep and Jose and all that, and he wanted to kind of have his
guys. Koeman's on the market.
For who?
with Koeman, though, I mean, if you look at the seven games that Unsworth has had, if he was given those seven games more, would they be in any worse a position than they are now?
I wouldn't have sacked him. I see why they did, but I wouldn't have sacked him.
They were not in big trouble when he got sacked. I think they're in trouble now.
And I think you make a good point. Would they have been any worse now had they have kept him?
No.
Probably not.
And at least then you continue with the mess that he kind of was a part of building, if that makes sense. And maybe try to get yourself out of it rather than just have to start again.
Well, you'd feel like for most managers you've got to give them at least two windows. When you want this drastic change and you want to change your style and you've got money to spend now, and kind of in a comparison to a lot of the clubs around you, one window, seven games, and then say, sorry, it hasn't worked out, move on. Yeah. It's just bonkers short
Was he there last year? Who was there last year? Everton.
It was Koeman. But what I'm saying, the big money's kind of rolled in this summer.
This is the first big window where
he got a chance to really go out and with purchasing power.
Sure.
You kind of thought, give it January as well. If you're still in that same position in February, then you've kind of got to go right. That's when you maybe turn to an Allardyce and say, short-term contract, get us out of trouble, and we'll talk about next season.
He's loving Allardyce.
That's what I'm saying. Whereas it's mad to kind of give him a job now to be getting a club like Everton. I still think you could make a progressive appointment now.
You know, with Allardyce, just touch on it. Was his contract up at Palace, or was it a mutual?
No, I think he was still under contract, and he retired. He said he was retiring. So he wasn't moving on.
This is the thing. Now,
I think he has a payment, doesn't he?
Yeah, because I don't know if you remember with Palace, I think it was Ian Dowie. They sued him because he said he was moving up north. That's why he wanted to leave Palace at the time as manager. And then he ended up taking the Charlton job.
Oh, geez, so you lied.
And then they sued him because of it. Now, I'm curious if the same thing's in place.
I think when you were talking about taking the Everton job, I think he's got something in his contract where he can't manage a Premier League club for, I think it might be 2 years.
Everton will just pay that off.
And if he does, there is a compensation payment to be made.
But this is what I mean about Everton being desperate.
But that's why I think he was touting himself around for international jobs.
I see.
The USA and Australia, I think, because that didn't breach the contract he had with Palace.
Okay, let's move on, guys. Before we get to our final topic, Ravit, we've got you here, first time on the pod. You are the club secretary at Dulwich Hamlet, and your club's going through a bit of a situation at the moment. Tell us a little bit about what's happening at Dulwich Hamlet and what your role at the club is.
Sure. So first and foremost, I will say that we're top of the table.
I like that.
And I'll say that because we're top of the table in a league that includes Billericay Town. For those who aren't too aware, this is a Essex-based club whose wage budget is £30,000 a week.
Stephen knows.
And has a lot of ex-Premier League players.
I know a few of them.
We're top of the table, we're going well, but unfortunately, whilst it's all rosy, it's all great on the pitch, off the pitch it's a completely different story. We're caught in the middle as a football club between Southwark Council and the property company who own our ground, Meadow Residential, who are a subsidiary company of Meadow LLP, which is a hedge fund in the States. And for the last 18 months, 2 years since Meadow were involved, they've been funding the football club with regards to wages, everything. In the last month, they've, because of a dispute with Southwark Council with regards to the land at which they're looking to, one, create property on, but also house a new football stadium for ourselves, that planning permission for part of the land was rejected by the council. So their stance on that was, okay, cool. If we've been rejected the lease on the ground, on part of the ground, we're not going to fund a football club anymore. So they pulled all of their funding. So what that meant was our weekly wage budget is £5,000 a week. Mm-hmm. So we've got to find that. We've got to pay, obviously, the club staff, everything else that comes with sort of running the football club. Fortunately, we've got very good fan base. On Saturday, when we won 1-0, we had 18,000.
1,800,
beg your pardon.
I was going to say, bloody hell, that is impressive.
That is impressive at that level. But even
1,800 is incredible at that level.
It's close.
If we got 18,000, that would solve all our problems. But 1,800, which again, even at that level, is incredible. So fortunately, the money that we're taking in from the gates and the bar, have now been given to us. Initially, it was never the case because Meadow funded everything. The stipulations which have been put on that, however, is that we take the profit from the bar and also the matchday revenue, obviously minusing all the costs and everything. But the issue that we have is that we can't control that profit. What by that I mean, we can't actually generate more profit. We can't control the costs, what it takes to actually produce that profit. So if we wanted to make, you know, £2,000-£3,000 more on a match day, we're not allowed to, because we're not allowed to bring the cost down. And by bringing the cost down, you know, we're paying for stewards, we're paying for security, we're paying for people in the bar. When not for all of the positions, but for a majority of the positions, there and 99% of non-league clubs, it's all run by volunteers. So then you don't have the overheads, you don't have the hourly rate that you have to pay people and whatnot. So stuff like that we can't control. So what we've now done in the last month is that we've put out a Just Giving page, we've put out a PayPal link for people to help us essentially continue to allow the club to move to run forward. Because we don't know when this dispute between the council and Meadow Residential is going to end. We don't know when they're going to turn around and say, you know what, we will back you. We don't, you know, we shouldn't have done what we did, because from their perspective, they've got some really bad PR now. We've had Sky Sports come down. We've had BBC. We were on the BBC Politics show last Sunday, you know, and it got to the point where they had to bring someone across from their from the States to appear on the show. And, you know, when you look at it on the face of it,
what's their justification for that? When they I didn't see the piece, but what's their justification? I understand that they feel hard done by with the council kind of saying you can't have planning permission.
Yeah.
But what's their justification when they stand up in front of on the BBC and it's kind of, you know, it's a poor, it looks poor PR-wise?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How do they justify that?
For them, they consider themselves to be our saviour. They state that because of the amount of money that they put in every year, that they cover the wage bill, that they essentially run the funding of the club. They don't run the club because, you know, it's a football committee that runs it for them. And that's where they think. They think that we're, as a club, that we're unsustainable. Whereas the football committee, the fans, we refuse to believe that, you know, a non-league club who gets 1,600 every Saturday home game and touching on 1,000 every Tuesday night for a home game, that is not unsustainable.
What would be their rationale for being unsustainable? Are the wages too high? Or
that's one of the reasons that they're claiming. But it was a wage agreement which was agreed at the start of the season, which they were more than happy to go along with. But it's just difficult. I mean, you've got a property company who, as with all property companies, they run business a certain way. And we all know football isn't like any other business. You can't translate what you do in the football world, in the business world, into football, because it just doesn't work like that. And which is why we see so many Premier League down to professional football, and obviously into non-league, why so many clubs go under, why they fold, because you've got people who are running the club to a certain extent and who are financing the club who don't know actually how football works. They don't understand that wage bills can go up, they can go down, you have bonuses, everything else that comes into it. So trying to get them to understand that is difficult.
So what's your role at the club?
Club secretary.
What does that entail?
That entails being a bit important, I like to think, but but no, it's essentially first port of call. So anything relating to the club is for myself, whether it's general inquiries, whether it's for this month, because Meadow have pulled out, myself, the chairman and the manager are working together to ensure that the players are paid on time, which they will be, because thankfully when we put a PayPal link out there for anyone wanting to donate to the cause, you know, we've raised over £10,000.
Just from the public?
Just from the public, which is incredible. Obviously, moving forward, it's some ask for that to happen every month. Yeah. But
there's some big talent at Dulwich Hamlet over the last couple of years, though. Is there an opportunity? Do you get to keep, if there was the opportunity to sell some of that young talent? I know that's painful for non-league sides to lose good young talent. But if the talent was moving on to, you know, bigger and better things, professional football, would you get to keep profits from that?
100%. Well, as it stands at the moment, yeah. I mean, one of the good things about the club and the academy is that our manager, Gavin Rose, at the end of every season, at least one player goes into the professional game.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's been some great talent.
Yeah, a lot
there was
of
a boy playing up front a couple of years ago. His name escapes me, but I mean, he's got a goal scoring record. It's unbelievable at that level. Like 50 odd goals.
Oh, Erhan Öztürmer?
Yeah. That was it, yeah. I mean,
good.
Very good. He doesn't score, he's not a great goal scorer, but a scorer of great goals.
Okay.
50. At that level,
when he's gone up, not as prolific, but
he had two seasons where he must have made about 80 odd appearances, and this was from like number 10 central midfield. He must have scored about 40 odd goals, 50 goals.
Just one question, something that we talk about a lot on the pod, especially around the time of pre seasons and transfer windows, is how clubs seem to mess up transfers of players, i.e. it might be, you know, late deals, late rushes, and just cocking deals up. I don't know how much say and role you have in terms of recruitment, but why does that happen? Why do clubs cock up transfers or leave it so late? And there's always this late flurry of trying to bring in players at the last minute. What's the rationale behind that?
I think it's a lot of it's budget. A lot of it's just putting a lot of pieces into the jigsaw. I'll give you an example. The agency that I last worked for, we represented a striker called Dave Tarpey. For those who don't know, he played for Maidenhead United. Yeah. And he scored a ridiculous amount of goals in the National South. And then he started the season on fire with the in the National League with them. And on transfer deadline day, we were all on the assumption he's not going anywhere. Not going anywhere. Transfer window obviously closed at 11. He got a call at half past... the Maidenhead chairman got a call at half past nine after he'd had training on the Thursday night, saying, we want Dave Tarpey. And obviously between them, they agreed a fee, and he got to Barnet at half past 10 and signed. So, and that's just that process.
Yeah.
From my perspective, and I'm not sure, I can't imagine it being too much different in the professional game, but as a club secretary, and I'm sure it's the same everywhere else, it's my signature which has to be on the transfer forms, whether I'm registering a player or transferring a player from one club to the other, which can be, you know, if it's a contract, it is, you know, your standard contract, ensuring all the terms are there, getting a witness to sign it, making sure the player's happy, making sure he's signing it. Obviously, my signature has to be, then it's sending it to the FA. And, you know, I've done numerous contracts this season where I've sent it off to the FA on, you know, Thursday, Friday, because that's when we've signed the player. And then you're waiting, okay, I can't play him on Saturday until I've got confirmation from the FA that he signed. And then when you get that email, send that email over to the league, because the league won't register him as a contracted player until they've got confirmation from the FA that says so-and-so is officially a contracted player at your football club. So it's from that, that's the process at this level. And I can only imagine that when you go into league football, and you know, especially with the Premier League, with obviously I'm sure you have to get FIFA involved and you know, agents galore and stuff like that. I can only imagine how
it just makes it even more the whole process when you see Daniel Levy kind of leaving things to the last minute, when you know it's that complicated and they know it's that complicated. Why leave it to the last minute?
Well, it also doesn't surprise
me. So much paperwork, I'll start the day before, I'll just make life easy for myself.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't surprise me why transfers don't get over the line as well. I think, is it the Leicester City player?
Yeah, Andre Silva.
Yeah, well, this, God knows what's going on, but that doesn't surprise me, because if you leave it at a certain time, and if he's obviously going from a
different
country, time zones, all this sort of stuff, with different rules and regulations, yeah, doesn't surprise me at all.
He's back in soon, isn't he? He's allowed to... The transfer officially goes through in January now, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, yeah. They rejected it. They tried to fast-track it before, but they rejected that. It didn't come in January. Okay, well, hopefully, though, that will be resolved soon, man, because I know from being a South London boy how popular your club is.
Yeah, of course.
Hopefully, there'll be some resolution. You guys can kick on again. Let's move on to our final topic, gentlemen. Don't know if anybody saw I assume all three of you saw the Liverpool game on TV in... BT Sports showed it, and they had in the studio Gerrard, Rio Ferdinand and Frank Lampard as their studio pundits. And they, I think it was post-match, they had a bit of a chat about various things, and they had a discussion about they were three members of the Golden Generation and why that perhaps didn't culminate in success for the national team. I think they picked it up because I think Rio Ferdinand did an interview for BBC on an NFL show talking about why that happened, and BT obviously thought we've got three guys.
He said he disliked, or not disliked, he fell out with Frank Lampard, effectively, is what he said in the NFL interview, wasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. And you've all seen the full interview or the full chat they had on BT Sport. And I was just thinking to myself, okay, I can kind of understand that, but I kind of can't. Let me get some other opinions on what you guys felt, especially as Liverpool and Chelsea fans. Gabriel, did you buy this explanation given by the three of them that club rivalries was a big factor in why they couldn't achieve success with the national team?
Yes and no. I think a few of them have got to look at it to say that when they pulled on the England shirt, they bottled it.
Yeah.
So I think that is first and foremost at the head of it. Or maybe I think England swapped with Sven Goran Eriksson for too long, and he wasn't really...
Just on your first point, sorry, of those three, who do you think bottled it? Who do you think never really... Who do you think just never really replicated their club form for England the most?
just say, I'm not exactly
he looks at Steve and just say, Steve, I'm sorry, bro, but it's one of your lot, you know.
No, you know what, I guess.
Well, put it this way, I know it ain't Frank Lampard.
You know what, to be fair, if you're going by World Cups, Frank Lampard probably never had a good World Cup for England, so that's fair. If you're generally speaking, I think there were times, I think out of Gerrard and Lampard, for me, Gerrard was the one who had the ability to hold and then burst forward.
Yeah.
And probably more than Lampard did. And I think sometimes he put that Stevie Mee thing above
Ferdinand covered it when he... I think Ferdinand actually had a couple of really decent World Cups for England, to be fair to him.
He did, yeah.
But I thought he actually made a very good point where he said if that was another country...
They would have found a way.
You find a way of getting Gerrard and Lampard to play in their preferred positions. You don't get one of them to compromise themselves or one of them... Like, we done it... When I say we, I'll caveat all of this with I follow Ireland. But like Matt Manaman was, you know, playing for Real Madrid, was a star for Real Madrid and kind of a free floating role. What do England do with him? Play wide left because we play 4-4-2.
But that goes back, you
have to fit into this 4-4-2 structure.
It wasn't even so much 4-4-2. It was let me get Scholes, Lampard, and Gerrard into the and Beckham into the same team. Mm. I think Lampard.
Yeah, but could you have played three at the back? Could you have played one up top? Like, these are all the things that maybe the likes of Spain, the likes of Germany, the likes of Holland, Ferdinand was implying that he feels these countries moulded their game around the talent they had.
I think one player would have had to drop.
I agree. At the time,
I called for Beckham because I thought Beckham was coming to the end of his time, and I thought at the same time, like, people were playing with pace, and Beckham wasn't quick. Beckham was very good at what he did, and he scored a lot of free kicks,
but didn't that one thing he was good at trump being quick? His delivery was that good, you could almost forgive him not. Do you know what I mean?
But in terms of getting a system, I think you get two flying wingers, a guy up front. 4-3-3 was what people were playing around that time ish. You get Lampard and Gerrard and a DM in the midfield, and I just don't think they ever really gave that long term chance because of Beckham and because of Scholes. And for me, that if they'd have given that a chance, I think they had a bit, at least for Lampard and Gerrard's perspective, it would have given them a better chance to play together.
So just to be clear, who are you saying of the three do you think never really did it for their country?
I would go with Gerrard.
Gerrard, okay. Yeah. Stephen, did you buy the explanation, or did it make sense to you? Did you listen to that and think, I can see that, or did you just think...
Yeah, I can see it, and I think it's... Maybe it was Lampard that said, or it could have been Gerrard, that the fact that a lot of English players stay based in the Premier League, so they're kicking lumps out of each other on a weekly basis, that rivalry...
That was a good point.
You quite often see, actually, and Spain have done very well over the last kind of 10 years to paper over it, but there is clearly a dislike between a lot of the Real Madrid and the Barcelona players.
Yeah.
And it took, I think, Ramos and maybe PK to kind of become friendly to try and bring those two squads together because people knew there was difficulties. So that's just two squads that were providing the majority of that Spanish team. When you had that Liverpool and Chelsea was a really intense rivalry around that time. Yeah. Liverpool United is always going to be an intense rivalry.
Yeah.
And then at the time, Chelsea were beating United to league, or they were taking league titles off each other. Arsenal were kind of in the mix. They were stronger back then than they are now. You're talking about 4 or 5 clubs providing the bulk of players that all kind of dislike each other.
Yeah.
Then they were saying Alan Shearer's in the mix. He's the legend. Yeah. So it was almost like he has a table.
Yeah,
the
Liverpool table.
That's what I'm saying. The Liverpool players. So I can see, like, because English players don't go abroad or don't travel as much, that a lot more of your homegrown players play for a core of clubs within that country.
Mm.
And if they're all doing well and they're coming up against each other regularly, there has to be a bit of bitterness because there has to be bite in them club games.
Mm.
And I'm assuming, and we've all seen it probably in our own lives, it's hard to turn off, to switch from kind of intense rivalry.
Yeah.
And then on Saturday Sunday, you're sitting down for dinner going, yeah, we're best buds. And I think if you look at smaller nations, if you look at the likes of Ireland, the likes of Northern Ireland, they don't have that talent pool that England have. Iceland is a good example at the moment. But they can bring them in and they treat it like a club side. They're actually as proud to play for Iceland because it might be the pinnacle of where they get to play.
Yeah.
So they give that almost their full attention, and they come in and they treat that like a club. they're all best friends around the camp, and when they go away, it's a great 3 weeks away to really enjoy it. Whereas Gerrard kind of gave the impression, it was like, I really hate being away with England because I'm not around with my mates. I can't talk to three quarters of the squad.
Yeah.
And that's okay for a couple of games in qualifying. And you're at home and you just pop down to Wembley for 2 days and then go home.
But for a month at a tournament,
that's got to get pretty draining and stressful in the end. Do you know what I mean? So I just, when I was looking at it, I did actually, a lot of what they were saying, I did think made sense. I thought there was, inter-club rivalry is always going to be a problem. And actually, when you're playing for successful clubs, maybe that becomes more important to you than, you know, winning the Champions League than getting to a quarter final of a World Cup. Whereas when you play for Iceland, you might be playing for Wolverhampton, no disrespect, but you're playing in the Championship. Playing in a World Cup is that's going to probably be the pinnacle of your career. So you appreciate it, you engage with it.
And I think it's not just a problem within football players. I've been to England games and heard club songs being sung, or people being booed, or things that you know that one set of fans say about a player from another club.
Well, you're talking about Beckham earlier. So if you were in David Beckham and you go back, and he clearly loved playing for England.
Yeah.
Death threats, burning effigies for doing something stupid at a World Cup.
Yeah.
But he had a pretty decent World Cup apart from that aside. Yeah. And England, you know, when you look at kind of where England are getting to in tournaments now, that was pretty successful. Kind of, he was vilified by England fans, but pure hatred.
Yeah.
Where was his safe space when he came back?
Is that
Old Trafford?
It was literally his white shirt disappeared as soon as he kicked Simeone in the back of the leg. Yeah. And his red shirt appeared again.
So you can understand them from the player's perspective. Yeah. Well, these England fans turned to me. They all hated me. They were threatening to do stuff to my wife, terrible stuff. But when I went back to Man United, my club, they embraced me. They took me back in. Yeah. They got me over that disappointment. So you'd understand in those players' heads in a year's time, well, actually, if it really comes down to it, where do my loyalties lie? I think it'll probably be the group of people that backed me up when I was at my lowest my lowest ebb, not the crowd that were basically burning me in a sarong.
And on that point, Ravid, do you think that's maybe why we see so many English players retiring relatively early as opposed to some of the foreign players in their national teams that go to 36 sometimes? Scholes retired relatively early. There's been a few England players that have kind of just been like, you know what, just Carragher, I think, has to be dragged back.
Carragher, I think, as Mopeny said, he preferred playing for Liverpool.
Yeah.
Like he had no
Do you think plays a role in why so many players end up retiring early? Because they just don't enjoy it.
I think it's not so much just the enjoyment side of it. Is do they actually see themselves being successful? Because I think Rio touched on it, that he felt, and it was almost a little bit in the group, that they felt inferior to other countries. Now, those three players in particular, we look at who the clubs that they played for in that period of time, their managers would never have let them go on into a Champions League fixture, a league fixture, even thinking 1% that they're inferior to the opposition or that they're coming up against.
That's true.
So to go into a World Cup, European Championship, whatever it might be, and to already feel defeated before you've even gone onto the pitch, you know, as a player, do you really want that? When you can go back to your club where you're loved, where, you know, your manager is 100% on you, that, you know, we're going to try and win the Premier League, we're going to try and win the Champions League. And I think between the three of them, they all pretty much said that their club managers at the time were better than the international managers that they played for as well.
But isn't it even at that time when England probably had one of the arguably top five squads in world football, even then, do you not think to yourself, I'm in a dressing room with some top players here. We are better than Italians. We are better than the Spanish team. We are better than the German team. Do you think even then? Okay, we can at least compete at the bare minimum with these Germans and these Spanish. Do you think even then they still never felt like, we can win this World Cup, we can win this European Championships?
Well, the onus is then going to be on the players to group together and actually put it onto the pitch. But between the three of them, it did, probably more so Rio, was that they needed a figurehead. They needed, whether it was a Mourinho, a Ferguson,
to kind of put it together and say, listen, we're going to win this World Cup this
but
year.
But Gerard actually said they were never coached to play a certain way. There was no style of play.
That was interesting.
He said, actually, it was like just gathering a really talented group of players and then just saying, go out and play.
Yeah.
So that works. What they were saying was that works against the kind of the weaker teams that they were clearly superior to. But when they were going out and playing the likes of Spain, Italy, Germany, I don't think they were implying that they felt inferior as individual players or even as a squad. Just I think they probably knew Spain had been coached to a very high standard and they were kind of going out a bit half-baked. And when it really came on, they weren't going to be able to live with it.
But also, it's that 30 years of, or 40 years, whatever it was, of non-success and that kind of defeatist mentality that is almost in the in the England squad. People get nervous of playing at Wembley. You hear about it all the time. I don't, and you never ever felt, whenever penalties came up, you never ever felt a penalty shootout was going to be won. Whenever England played a big team in a tournament, you always felt they were going to lose, and that came through from the players. There wasn't that confidence, that swagger that they would have when they were playing for their club teams.
Do you feel that maybe, Rabbit, they should be a little bit embarrassed about the fact that they did kind of consciously or subconsciously play at 50% for their nation? It's national duty in football terms, but yet they kind of never really, really delivered for their nation, especially with the squad they had. Do you feel they should be maybe a little bit embarrassed about that?
I think it's important to actually take what they said in remembrance that it is a long time ago, but it's also in hindsight as well. You know, they all pretty much said at the time when you're in the England camp and you're going from a club perspective, emotionally, everything that's involved in it, you're not going to consciously go to England and not put in that amount. It's only when you actually finish your career and actually see, okay, this is what I achieved at club level, this is what I achieved at international level, the two don't match. So it's, and then obviously looking at the reasons for it, I don't think it was anything consciously at the time that they meant to do it.
There were some very fine margins for that particular England squad. They were penalty, a couple of missed penalties, a kind of a dubious disallowed goal for Sol Campbell. They were very close to making a breakthrough and getting to a semi-final or something. And once you get there, you don't kind of know. They didn't get a lot of breaks go their way either.
Is that England team a symbol of, or just emphasises the point of how important a manager is? Because a good manager with that England team wins the World Cup, wins the European Championship. Or do you just feel
a bit odd about it. Like, you can't say that they didn't have... I know the players clearly, and it was very obvious that they felt they didn't have proper structure and proper coaching, and they felt the managers were a bit inferior. Like Fabio Capello, when he came in, that was a guy that came with an absolutely massive reputation. Yeah. Had won everything in the game.
He didn't have that team though. The team that he had wasn't.
I think that he was right at the end of it, and maybe they were gone. Slight Sven, I think, probably was the one that had them in the prime. kind of in their prime. But like, he wasn't. I'm not. He clearly didn't do a great job because they didn't win anything. But he also wasn't a joke manager. Has won stuff in Serie A, which is a very well respected league. So, it wasn't like they just plucked this guy from obscurity and he kind of, no one had ever heard of him. He clearly wasn't up to the job. He clearly must have got things wrong. But I think, and the players pointed out, I think they've got to take some responsibility. And it sounded like they kind of did take a bit of responsibility for, they didn't do everything they should have done. Managers didn't do everything they should have done. And maybe the structures around England in general didn't allow them to flourish.
And just finally, how does Gareth Southgate ensure that doesn't happen again? Or does he not have the same problem in that he doesn't have players that are all competing for Champions League and Premier League? There's not so many core English players that are competing for the two top trophies.
It can't happen again because you haven't got the same quality. So, it's not gonna, but I mean, if you're saying how does Gareth Southgate make sure that the England team is a success moving forward,
and just mention and people that want to turn up for national duty, because Gerald made the point that he speaks to Coutinho and they can't wait to leave Liverpool. I mean, that says more about Liverpool, but to go to Brazil for national duty
every week. But start of the show, end of the show.
How does Southgate make sure that he creates an environment where international weekends come, players don't just, they actually want to go and play for England and want to do well for England?
Maybe he just needs to start picking players who do want to come.
Even if they're inferior.
I mean, you saw kind of what happened in the last set of friendlies.
Yeah.
And maybe that kind of sense of competition will drive people to gravitate more back towards. If there's a good feeling around England, there's a buzz around England, then people will want to be involved. people don't want to be involved at the moment because it's kind of you're set. People are set up to fail.
Mm.
You know, you go through a tournament campaign. You never get any credit for qualifying because and why should you?
Mm.
And then you get to the tournament and you lose and you come back and you're slated and for the first 6 months you can't go to any ground without being slated. Maybe if they created a good vibe about it by putting some youngsters in there who don't have the baggage, who the public will give more time to, I think more people would be more inclined to kind of rejoin the squad.
Good point. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on this week's FFP. G, Steve, thank you very much. Ravit, first time, brilliant performance. Thank you very much for coming on. Hopefully we'll come back at some point. Soon, big game next weekend, Arsenal United. I think there's a couple of games with teams involving at the bottom of the league as well. So we'll go through all those teams, those games on next week's pod. Don't forget to subscribe to the pod via iTunes. We're on Spotify. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter, FFP_11. Until next week, peace.